With the summer solstice happening earlier this week, summer is now upon us, gardens are in full swing, and it's time to train your tomatoes. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Ben Stanton, in for Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day. It's hard to imagine calling a garden complete without a tomato plant, but although they are very common, relatively easy to deal with, there are pitfalls, and one of the important factors is how to support the plant as it gets bigger. We'll cover tomato topics and answer all your lawn and garden questions with ISU's Ajay Nair and Richard Duran. Tomato training and your calls after this news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Ben Stanton, in for Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day. In a few minutes, we'll be answering your questions about lawn and garden by way of your calls and emails or possibly Facebook posts. And we'll be doing that in a few minutes with Richard Duran, ISU Extension. But first, we're going to be talking about tomatoes and what should you be doing with your tomato plants at this point in the year. And with us now is Ajay Nair, Assistant Professor of Horticulture at Iowa State University. Thanks so much for being on again.
Good morning, Ben.
Well, glad to have you on, and I'm excited to hear about what you have to say about tomato plants. Mine is not doing so well, but that's because I've been neglecting it. I'm sure that's probably part of it. But before we get into some of the ways to train and prune and take care of your tomato plants, can you describe just briefly how a tomato plant grows that can give us some insight about how we should take care of it?
Sure. So I know there are a lot of tomato enthusiasts in the state, and we all get excited when May comes and it's time to plant and transplant our tomatoes, which is great. And as the tomato plant grows, when you transplant them in the first or the second week of May, it will take about a month and a half for the plant to start, you know, growing upright. And once it reaches about 12, 18 inches in that range, it starts to topple. You will see the leaves are touching the ground. The plant is not straight anymore, too much of weight to carry for the plant. And that is the time when we need to start thinking about staking. And staking is nothing but making sure there is a support for that plant to grow upright. There are multiple ways of staking, and there are multiple advantages of staking as well.
Okay, well, let's get into those ways. What's the simplest way?
So simplest way would be to put a cage around the tomato plant. And these cages can be found at different, you know, garden stores. These cages are about 36 inches tall so that, you know, they can support the plant as the plant grows. One thing we need to be careful about when we buy these cages is that the diameter of the base and the top of the cages. So we need to have a cage which is about 18 inches in diameter at the bottom and about, you know, 24 and 36 inches at the top. These cages help the plant to kind of be confined and have some support as the plant produces more leaves and more fruits.
Right. So the openings are important, but the openings on the side seem important too, so you can reach in and get that fruit.
That's
right?
A very good point, Ben. Yeah. Oftentimes we don't think about that. Yeah. So the purpose of staking, let's go with the purpose and then we'll get into that. So number one is to make sure that you keep the leaves upright and not touch the ground, because there could be a lot of diseases that a tomato plant can get by splash, by wind. So when you keep the plant in a cage upright, you kind of eliminate or reduce the chances of getting those diseases. Now, staking also helps a gardener to make sure that they prune their tomatoes well and easily, because now you can see the plant upright, you can take the suckers out. Staking also helps the plant to produce more yield. You know, we have seen more productivity when the plants are staked. And if you're a gardener, if you are not staking your plant, you don't want to play gymnastics around the plant to harvest the fruit and locate it. So that's where the size of the cage and the side comes into play, because you should be able to easily insert your hand in there and harvest the fruit or remove the sucker.
That's right. And you know, for I think I hinted at my, you know, how good of a gardener I am, which is mediocre at best. But so when you're talking about the suckers, what are you removing? What are you talking about?
So the tomato suckers are these stem or like structures that originate between the main stem and the axil of the leaf. So you will see a new shoot growing on between the axil of the leaf and the main stem. So those are suckers. Depending on the tomato cultivar, there are ways you remove these suckers. If the tomato plant is a determinate tomato, which means the plant grows for about 3 to 4 feet, and after that, the apical meristem forms a flower and doesn't grow anymore, that's a determinate plant. In the determinate plant, you remove the suckers until the first cluster of fruits or the flowers. It is a little different on indeterminate and more work because in the case of indeterminate plants, you keep removing the sucker as the plant keeps growing because the plant never stops growing. The apical meristem in an indeterminate tomato plant is always not a floral but a leaf meristem. It just keeps producing more and more leaf and stem. So with an indeterminate, the suckering is a continuous process, but with a determinate one, you just stop at the first cluster.
Right. So with the indeterminate plants, would just keep getting bigger and out of control if you didn't do something about
that's
them.
That's true. True. And you know, when you have too much of foliage, too much of stem and leaf, there will be high relative humidity, and you know the fungus and the pathogens absolutely love that atmosphere, you know, that environment. They want to have an area which is high in relative humidity, so they can, you know, produce more and cause more damage to your plant.
Right. Okay, well, so we talked about cages, and we see a lot of people use those. You see them in the stores. Are there other options? Are there new ways of training your tomato plant? What else is available?
Cages are a good strategy when you do not have many plants. But in a commercial setup where you have rows and rows of tomatoes, cages won't work. In that case, you would use a stake and a twine system. And what you would do is you would put stakes in the tomato row every other plant. So let's say you have a row of tomatoes and it had, let's say, about 30 tomato plants. So you would put a stake on both ends. And those stakes are usually metal stakes. It could be T-posts because they give more strength to the whole
system. It has to be able to support the system of rope or string or whatever you're using.
Exactly, right. Ben. You know, when the plants are fully loaded with the fruits, you can't even lift when it starts falling. You know, the whole structure could be really heavy. So on the
good problem to have. Good problem to have.
That's so true. So you would put the T-posts at the sides, and then within the row, every other plant or every two plants, you can put a wooden stake. And this wooden stake is usually a 1x1, about 6 to 7 feet high. And you take a twine, put it on one side, start one side on the T-post. You will have two plants in front of you. Sweep those plants, come to the wooden stake, take a twist, keep going down the row, take a twist on all these stakes, and you come back on the other side. So that way, you are kind of sandwiching the plant between these twines. And that way, the plants stay erect. The leaves do not touch the ground. There is more airflow. There is less diseases, and the plant is more productive.
So in that case, you're not attaching the plant. You're not attaching the plant to this string. It's just being supported.
That's correct.
As opposed, now, is that what you also do in the cage? I mean, I know sometimes people are attaching branches.
Yeah. Yeah, you don't have to because the cage is kind of an all-around structure, right? So you don't have to attach the plant to the cage. The plant will, you know, fall on either one of the sides and the branches will start growing within the cage. So you don't have to tie the plant.
And I mean, I guess I'm always worried when I'm handling the plant. I'm going to damage it. I'm going to break off a branch that I don't want to break off and that kinds of thing.
Yeah. I mean, you know, in all my experience growing different vegetables, tomatoes are very strong and resilient plants. You know, they don't die that easily.
Well, I guess they don't stand a chance when I'm there, but that's just fine. So are there other options? We went through a small scale, larger scale. I mean, I hear people talk about training a tomato plant to go up a rope or a string. Is that realistic or do people do that?
Yeah, so that is more of a commercial setup, especially with the indeterminate plants. In that case, you don't use a trellis, you don't use a staking system. What you do is you have a twine, which with a clip you attach to the bottom of the plant, and you attach this vine to the top on a wire, strong wire that can support this plant, and you just keep train this plant on that twine. So that's a very common system that we use in the indeterminate. In that case, yes, you do attach the plant to the twine with a clip, and the plant, you know, just holds on to the twine and just keeps going up, And in some cases, you know, especially in the indeterminate, when the plant is out of reach, you can actually slowly lower the twine as well. So there are different type of contraptions and twines that come in roll-ups, which you can slowly pull down so that you can easily harvest the fruit when the fruit is mature.
Okay. Well, should we talk about pruning next? Is that, how can we go through the basis of pruning? Everyone wants to prune for more yield, usually, but also, I guess, you know, for the size of the plant, depending on what space you have. But how should we go about pruning?
Yeah, so pruning in tomatoes is a critical process, and it needs to be done. And as I indicated earlier, depending on if the plant is a determinate and indeterminate, the degree and the time span of pruning is different. In a determinate plant, you keep removing the suckers. When you say pruning, it's removing the suckers. You remove the suckers until the first fruit cluster. And after that, you let go. You don't remove the suckers. In the indeterminate, you keep removing the suckers at the plant as the plant grows. Now, it is important, pruning is important, because if there's too much of foliage, the plant is not able to partition the nutrients in a very productive way. So it will spend a lot of energy sending the nutrients to the leaves, which in turn should be going to the fruit. So the fruits will be smaller, there will be less fruits. So research has shown that when we prune our plants, the fruits are bigger and the plant is more productive in terms of yield and performance.
So we're not talking about, if there's a full branch grown, we're not clipping that off like we might prune a different kind of plant. It's a different kind of pruning for tomatoes.
Sometimes if you, let's say you got busy, there are things happening, and you forgot to remove the suckers, these suckers will keep growing as if it's a main branch. And once it's that stage, I would suggest not to remove the sucker.
Just
because let it go. We technically try to remove the suckers when they're about 1 to 2 inch big, and that's the right time to deal with them. If they have gone out of hand, you know, I think we might be doing more damage by removing the suckers and tearing the stem. You know, things can go wrong, so just leave it at that time.
If I don't know if I have a determinate or indeterminate plant, is there an easy way to find that out?
Good question. So when you buy the seed, packet will tell you if it's a determinate or an indeterminate.
So, if I bought a plant that was already a plant and transplanted it. So I mean, and having forgotten to check, is there a way to tell before it just stops growing?
The only other way you'll be able to find out is when the plant is about 3 to 4 feet in height, the terminal bud. So just look for the terminal bud in the stem. If it becomes a flower bud, then you know it's a determinate one. And you'll see the fruit set in the determinate cultivars to be more heavy and more thick, whereas the indeterminate ones, the fruit clusters come slow one after the other.
Okay, well, we're almost out of time. We'll be taking calls in just a minute. And thank you. We're talking with Ajay Nair of ISU, Assistant Professor of Horticulture at Iowa State University. We'll also be joined in just a minute by Richard Duran, and we'll be answering your calls. Please give us a call at 866-780-9100. That's 866-780-9100. Or you can email us, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. It's Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa, Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Ben Stanton. We're talking about tomatoes this hour, but we're taking your calls now and answering your emails. We've been talking with Ajay Nair, Assistant Professor of Horticulture at Iowa State University, and joined now by Richard Duran, ISU Extension Horticulturist. Hi, Richard.
Good morning.
Glad to have you on. Well, we'll be at the phones here in just a minute. Reminder that the phone number is 866-780-9100, or email us, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. I wanted to go to an email from Dennis N. Moline. He says, I've been using aluminum sulfate and various sulfur-based products to turn and keep my wide-leaf hydrangeas blue. He asked, would iron oxide yield a similar result? He says his neighbor says that driving rusty nails into the ground around each plant would also work. Is he right?
Well, the rusty nails might be of some benefit, but I would typically use just either aluminum sulfate or elemental sulfur. Those materials will lower the pH. But they also have to understand that the soil pH changes very grudgingly. So when you apply aluminum sulfate or sulfur, it may be a year or more before it really lowers the pH. It takes time, so.
Go ahead.
And most Iowa soils tend to be fairly high as far as the soil pH. They tend to be above 7, maybe 7.1, 7.3. So you have to add quite a bit of material eventually to lower the pH.
And it's, but putting rusty nails in the ground also could help.
It might help a little bit. Especially if you have some rusty nails.
Well, especially as someone with small kids, it seems like a bad idea to add rusty nails to the environment. But, you know, that's just me. So, well, let's go to the phones. Let's go see if we can go to Charles from Cedar Rapids. Charles, hi, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Go ahead.
I've got a question about it's a sunburst honey locust that I planted probably about 3 years ago, and it's about 15 to 20 feet tall now. And this summer it had a tremendous growth spurt, mostly up at the top, and it's started 2 weeks ago listing to one side. It goes up about 9 feet, perfectly straight, and then the rest of the tree just tilts to the south. And it's awfully high to try to stake it at this point, but I have gotten up there on a ladder and looked, and it's not broken from wind damage or anything. It just has a tremendous amount of new growth at the top.
Right. It sounds like maybe it was pruned too heavily initially. By that I mean sometimes we get carried away and remove some of the lower limbs too quickly, and those lower limbs help to stabilize the tree. And if you remove them, let's say, too quickly, you get all this top growth. And because you get all this top growth, then it gets kind of lopsided or whatever, or it leans. So at this point, I guess I would just leave it go and maybe try to prune it early next spring, before bud break, and trying to kind of straighten it out if you can by pruning it early next spring. But
okay,
staking
so it more towards the top than in the spring?
Well, kind of redirect it if you can, as far as if there's a shoot that's growing more upright, maybe pruning back the branch that grows more horizontal. If you kind of cut it back somewhat, you're kind of hindering its growth and directing the growth toward the upper shoot or stem.
Okay. Sounds great. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you very much, Charles. Appreciate your call. Let's go to Dana in Ames. Dana, go ahead.
My question's about tomatoes. A lot of years I've tried to grow tomatoes, and I keep having the same thing happen to the leaves. They seem to get little spots on them, and then they turn yellow, and gradually the bottom sets of leaves start falling off, and I don't really get much fill in the tomato plant for leaves. I'm just wondering if this is a bug or a disease. Thank you.
Yes. So, Dana, what you are experiencing are two commonly found diseases in tomato. One of them is called the early blight, and the second one is called septoria blight. Both of them are caused by fungus. The best way to deal with this problem is to make sure that you rotate your tomato plant. So do not put a tomato or any other vegetable of the same family, the solanaceous family, in that spot for 3 years. So let's say you have tomato this year, wait for 2, 3, 4, and the fifth year is when you put another plant from the same family. This is a very common problem, it's challenging because you see these spots coming up, and there are differences between these two spots. If you see a spot which has dark sides and the middle show concentric rings, if you see something similar to that, then it's early blight. And if you don't see concentric rings, but you just see a dark bordered circle with lighter tan area in the middle, that's septoria. So you can spray fungicides, but in a small scale, we do not recommend. The best way to do is to buy certified clean seeds and rotate your tomato plants.
Okay, thank you much.
Thank you very much, Dana. Again, you can call 866-780-9100, 866-780-9100. Email us, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. A few more tomato questions here. One's an email from Angela in Iowa City. What pH effect might be expected from using cocoa mulch on tomatoes?
I would say the pH won't be affected much. The coco mulch is generally more towards the acidic range, but I don't see any drastic change. Richard, you want to chime in?
No, the pH is so stable that anything that you might put, like pine needles or whatever, that might be slightly acidic, they're going to have very little effect on the soil pH. It's very stable.
Is cocoa mulch something we're buying at stores or making ourselves? Something I've not heard of.
Well, it's actually cocoa bean shells, and you can buy those in bags. They're very attractive. They have a very nice smell, initially at least. When you put it down, definitely smells like chocolate. We commonly use the cocoa bean shells more in landscape areas around flower beds and things like that, where it's very attractive and you want to kind of show it off. But you can use it in a vegetable garden too. It works very nicely. It breaks down fairly quickly. So in the fall of the year, you can basically, what remains, kind of work it into the soil. Now, one thing that does happen when you use cocoa bean shells is if we have some very wet weather, you'll get a mold or something growing on the surface where it turns kind of white. So at that point, it's not nearly as attractive if that happens.
Okay. Okay, let's see if we can go to Zach. Zach calling from Vermont. Zach, you're growing tomatoes in Vermont?
Hello, Mr. Stanton.
Hi there.
Great to hear your voice.
Thanks for calling.
Gentlemen, thank you for your time. Yes, I'm growing tomatoes, and my question was, what time of day is the best to water them? And when I'm watering, should I avoid hitting the leaves themselves and go straight for the soil or cover everything?
Zach, you have your basics correct. We do not want to wet the foliage and rather channel the water towards the root, because the problem is if you water the foliage and the foliage stays wet, and if you do it later part of the day, let's say in the evening, there is more chance of that foliage to remain wet and create a more conducive environment for the pathogens to grow and thrive. So ideally, it'll be good to water in the early part of the day and not wet the foliage, just focus on the root system.
Okay.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Thanks for your call, Zach. Appreciate that. 866-780-9100. 866-780-9100. Email us, talkofiowa at iowapublicradio.org. And let's go to Josh in Iowa City. Josh, are you there?
Yeah. Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Go ahead.
Yeah, so I, about 5 years ago, planted some peaches and plums in my backyard in Iowa City, and I think they're Alberta and Santa Rosa varieties, and didn't let them fruit out for several years because they were little. Mm-hmm. Last year got great fruits out of them, and now this year I saw one peach tree started to get this white, gooey ooze coming out of the peaches, and then I also noticed the tips of some of the peaches. The tips of the branches were turning brown, and it's only on one of them. And so, was also they're close in my backyard, close to the plum trees. And one of my plum trees is starting to show some of the same. It's almost like snot coming out of the fruit.
Okay,
very nice image. Thank you.
Well, something has damaged the fruit. It could be an insect, or it could be something maybe like hail. But something has damaged the fruit, and in response to that damage, the fruit is oozing out this sticky sap. And so you'll see it on branches too. You'll see these big blobs of kind of amber-colored sap on the branches or the trunk. Basically, it's the response to some type of injury that may have occurred to that tree or fruit.
Okay.
If you take off the fruit and take a knife, and cut through it, you may see an insect inside, and that would basically tell you exactly what occurred. If you don't see that, then I would assume it's some type of environmental damage. So,
And what about the sort of dark tips of the peach, of the one peach tree, like the tips of the branches lost their leaves and turned dark? Is that a related or different problem?
I think that's a different problem. I'm not sure what's responsible for that. Realize that peach trees in Iowa tend to be definitely short-lived, that oftentimes they die within 10 or 15 years. They're just not very well adapted to our climate. They don't like our hot, dry summers, are not real fond of our cold winters, and so they tend not to live very long in Iowa. So Oftentimes, within a few years, you start to see dieback, and usually within 10 or 15 years, they may be gone. So,
okay.
So you enjoy them when they do produce, because they don't produce very long. So,
okay.
Well, thanks for your call, Josh. Good luck. I hope it works
thank
out
you.
For you. Yep. Thank you for your call. 866-780-9100. Let's see if we can go to Keith. Keith calling from Iowa City.
Hey, hello there.
Hi.
About 5 years ago, we transplanted some raspberry plants from another house to the house that we're in now. And we put these in two different locations in the yard.
Mm-hmm.
One location is fruiting very nicely. The other location, the raspberry plant looks fantastic. It flowers up, and then the little individual buds on the flower disappear, and I don't get any fruit off of that plant.
Okay.
It looks great, and it doesn't fruit. I'm looking for how to make my plant fruit.
Well, I'm not sure that you can. How much sun do those plants get?
Quite a bit.
Okay. Typically, for them to develop good quality fruit, they need at least 6 hours of direct sun, and they also need at least an inch of water per week as the fruit are developing. If they have those two things, they should go ahead and form good quality fruit. Now, if they're okay. not, if they're not, and they receive both those two things, I might suspect that maybe there's a disease or virus involved, which is preventing the plant from developing or producing mature fruit. And so that may be something, if it's a virus, it's a lifelong thing. It's never going to produce well. You can't control a virus. So if that's the case where they're doing the same thing every year, they're just not fully maturing and ripening, then I would suspect if they have the proper environment that they may have a virus, and I would be inclined probably to dig them up and destroy them if they're not producing like they should.
It is not that far. It's maybe 5 feet from a utility pole in the backyard. It's got the creosote in the wood. Could that be an issue?
It shouldn't be, no. No.
Okay.
That should not be an issue. But like I said, if they're getting enough sunlight, if they're getting enough moisture, and they're still not maturing like they should, then I'm suspecting possibly a virus, because that can affect the plant. Appearance-wise, it may look perfectly fine as far as healthy, but it may be affecting its fruiting. So it could be a virus, possibly.
All right. Well, I'll make sure it gets enough water. It definitely gets the sun, and we'll push the water harder, and then we'll dig it up if we need to. I appreciate the help.
Thank you for your call, Keith. We appreciate that. Let's go to Ron. Ron calling from New Liberty. Is that right? New Liberty? Are you there?
That's right, Ron. New Liberty.
Go ahead.
Okay, I've got a couple of cedar trees that I dug out of a ditch, and I planted them in my yard. When I planted them, they were about 3 foot tall, and they're now about 6 to 7 feet tall. I want to make them not grow any taller. If I cut it off, will I kill the tree?
Well, now the red cedar is a tree that wants to be 30, 35 feet tall eventually. And so it's hard to keep it at a size where it doesn't want to be. You can prune it, but you'd have to prune it every year in the spring of the year, probably sometime around, let's say, early to mid April. And basically when you prune that thing, most of the foliage is toward the outer portion of the branch or canopy. You might have, let's say, 6 or 12 inches of actual foliage or needles. And so in the spring of the year, you can go out there and you can remove maybe 4 or 5, 6 inches of that growth. You still have some green needles below that. You need that for that plant to keep on growing or staying alive. If you just whack off the top, that's it. It's not going to develop a new leader, per se, usually. So you would have to basically go out there on a yearly basis, typically in the spring, and prune it back lightly and keep it at a certain size. You can do that, but it's very high maintenance.
Okay.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you very
Thanks
much for your call, Ron. Thank you for calling in. And I wanted to go to an email quickly before we get to a break. This is more of a suggestion about how to handle your tomatoes. And Heather in Davenport writes, My parents have used tomato cages made from swine fencing for over 40 years with fabulous results. They're bent into a cage of roughly 2 foot diameter, have 4-inch square openings for removing the fruit, and a cluster of three cages lashed around a metal fence post. She says they're sturdy and have lasted for decades. So there's a recycling idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and especially if you're at a farm and such resources are available, absolutely, you can go ahead and use that. It's all about, you know, training, giving the plant a support so that it can produce well and yield well.
I assume this is some fencing that's movable because, like we discussed before, you want to be rotating where tomatoes are, not putting plants in the same spot.
That's correct, Ben. Yeah, we need to keep in mind that diseases like the early blight and the septoria, leaf mold, they can all overwinter here in Iowa. They overwinter on plant residue. They overwinter in the soil, on weeds that are in the nightshade family. So we absolutely do not want to put a tomato in the same place the next year. We have to practice at least a 3 to 4 year rotation.
Okay, you're listening to Talk of Iowa Horticulture Day. We're talking with Ajay Nair, Assistant Professor of Horticulture at Iowa State University, and Richard Duran, ISU Extension Horticulturist. And we're taking your calls, 866-780-9100, 866-780-9100. Email us, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.com. It's Talk of Iowa, back in a minute. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Ben Stanton, in for Charity Nebbe. We're talking about plants today on Horticulture Day, and especially tomato questions. If you have tomato questions, you can call us 866-780-9100, 866-780-9100, Talk of Iowa at iowapublicradio.org. But we're also answering all your questions about your lawn and garden and the plants in your life. And let's see if we can get back to the phones and talk with Mary, who's been waiting patiently from Morning Sun. Mary, go ahead.
Good morning. My problem is my coneflowers are starting to bloom, and I have a lot of them, mm-hmm. and they're looking deformed somewhat,
mm-hmm.
and definitely weak blooms.
Okay.
A few years ago, I had aster rust. Is that what it's called?
Aster yellows.
Aster yellows. I had that in some asters, and at that time it affected some rutabaga also, and maybe just a few coneflowers, but not really the coneflowers that much.
Okay.
But this is beginning to look a little bit like that.
Okay.
With the deformed blooms. The foliage is perfectly fine and looks really healthy.
Okay. Well, there's two things. If you're referring to the purple coneflower.
Yes.
There are two things that can deform the actual flower. Aster yellows is one, which is a very unique organism. It's a phytoplasm, I think. And it will cause the flower heads to be very distorted, almost leaf-like. We see a lot of leaf-like
mm-hmm.
tissue.
I have some of that, right?
So that's what you see. But also, there's a little mite that will do the very same thing. So you have very similar symptoms where you have these rather abnormal flowers, obviously not normal at all. They're distorted. They're mm-hmm. quite unusual. And so it could either be aster yellows or the insect, the mite. If it's aster yellows, that's a permanent thing. It's not going to go away. And so your best course of action is to remove the plant because you can't cure it. And it could spread to other plants. On the other hand, if it's a mite, it may not be back next year. So it's kind of a mm-hmm. hard thing to do because it's hard to differentiate which is which. What you might want to do is maybe take some photos of the plant and the flower heads and send those to our plant diagnostic clinic and see if they can make a determination based on photos. The email address for the clinic is P as in plant, I as in insect, D as in disease, C as in clinic, at iastate.edu. And what I would do is take a photo of the plant in general so they can see the plant, what it looks like.
Right.
And then maybe two or three close-ups of the affected flower buds.
Okay.
And see what they can decide.
It's starting to bloom, and this is a whole sheaf of plants, you know.
Yeah,
what I mean?
Right. So
it is adjacent to the area where the rutabaga and asters were. But now the asters have come back, and they're perfectly healthy.
Okay. Well,
so, you know. But I think that was aster yellow. I think I called you with that one too. And the foliage was funny on the asters. This foliage is not. It looks perfectly normal.
Yeah, aster yellows can affect a number of different plants, both annuals and perennials. Oftentimes, like for example on marigolds, if they have aster yellows, they definitely do turn kind of a yellow green color. They're not a healthy green, but kind of a yellow green.
Mm-hmm.
And when they get it with the marigolds, they form the flower buds, but again, they don't open properly. So oftentimes with aster yellows, you do see some discoloration of the foliage. And that's why I want to include an actual photo of the plant, too,
okay.
So the clinic staff can see that plant also.
Okay. One more quick. I don't want to take more time than is my
Quickly.
Share, but the ground there, should I worry about that?
Well, you really can't. This phytoplasma is in the plant, and it's spread from plant to plant by insects, sap-feeding insects, but it's not in the soil per se. So if you have a plant, if it actually has aster yellows, your only course of action is to dig it up and destroy it so that it doesn't spread to other plants. But it's not in the soil per se, no.
Okay, thanks so much.
Okay, thank you for your call, Mary. 866-780-9100. Talk of Iowa at iowapublicradio.org. Let's go to Ray calling from Mason City. Go ahead.
Yeah, I have basically two questions. One, I have I want to move some ferns where for some reason they're doing much better this year than they have in the past because they're outproducing the weeds around them. And but I need some move because they're interfering with other plants. And two, I have I believe it's a hydrangea, not the snowball plant, but the one that's similar to it, that died over the winter. Is that unusual or?
Well, let's start with the ferns. As far as moving them, right now would be a very difficult time going into summer. June, July, August, with the heat, it would be very difficult to do. It could be done, but very difficult. So if I was going to do it, the ideal time would be early next spring. Early next spring would be ideal. If you can't wait till next spring, then I would do it maybe later on in early fall, like in September, when the weather conditions have moderated, when we're not having extreme heat. So either later on, maybe in early fall, or preferably early next spring. As far as the hydrangea, there are a number of different hydrangeas. The white flowering types, the old-fashioned hydrangeas, should be perfectly hardy in your area. But there are quite a few big-leaf hydrangeas, and they're very popular in recent years. They're not nearly as hardy. And so in the Mason City area, if it's a big-leaf hydrangea, maybe it winter-killed.
No, it seemed like it was, I wouldn't call it extremely big, but I'm looking across the street at my neighbors that have some, and they're all doing fine.
Right.
I just wondered if I might have cut it off too deeply or something.
You pruned it back this spring?
Last fall.
Okay. Well, typically...
The parts that didn't grow or were... that had produced flowers and were just dead.
Okay.
I've done that almost every year without a problem.
Okay. Well, the old-fashioned hydrangeas, they have white flowers, and they're perfectly hardy here in Iowa. The big-leaf hydrangeas typically have pink or blue flowers, and they're not nearly as hardy here in Iowa as the other type. So.
Well, these are white.
Okay. Well, I'm not sure what's going on, but... I would typically prune them in late winter, early spring.
Okay. Ray, thank you very much.
Thank
Good
you.
Luck with that.
Appreciate
thank
it.
You for calling.
Bye.
Appreciate it. And we'll keep taking your calls in a minute here. Just wanted to quickly get to an email from Jill. She writes, I have a problem with fungus in my tomato plants every year. I have two large gardens and rested one of them for the first time this year, so rotation will not be an option for at least two more years. I was just getting ready to apply Bordeaux mixture to my tomatoes in the second garden when, and you'll like this, Ajay, when she says she heard the tomato guru that was on the program say he did not recommend fungicides for use in small production. So tomato guru, Ajay Nair.
So the reason I mentioned that, Ben, when we start using a fungicide, it's not a one-time operation. So you have to keep up with it on a regular basis. So if I, it's more of a prophylactic measure. So every 5 day or every 7 day, you have to spray your fungicide. And me and Richard were discussing this here earlier. And if you spray, you have to make sure that you mix it properly. You spray it in a uniform manner. And sometimes it becomes too tedious, especially in a homeowner type situation. There are fungicides that are available to homeowners to manage, especially the early blight and the septoria. These are chlorothalonil based products. And if you go to a garden center, you can easily find these products. There are instructions how to apply, and it could be used. I mean, and I would say this is more of a last resort if you want to use a fungicide. The best thing would be to do is make sure you rotate, you keep your plots clean, you know, nicely. You have to follow sanitation. And if you are doing this and still not able to manage these diseases, then, of course, you can use chlorothalonil-based products to manage these fungi.
Okay, and quickly, another email from Karen in Iowa City. We've talked about rotating tomatoes, but she's asking about container planting tomatoes and asking, we didn't really get into that. What should she do? You just toss out the soil? You wouldn't reuse it? Is that the way you'd rotate if you're container gardening?
Yeah, typically when you're growing things in containers, there's actually no soil in the potting mix. It's basically soilless, typically composed of organic matter, maybe some perlite, that type of thing. And usually you dump the material each year. And that's because over time, the material in the potting mix begins to break down or degrade. And when that does, when that occurs, then it's not nearly as good as far as a growing medium for the plant. So we typically dispose of it every year. I typically just add it to my garden somewhere.
Okay, let's get back to the phones. And Kimberly calling from North Liberty. Go ahead.
Hi there. Thanks so much for taking my call.
Hi, of course.
I love the show.
Oh, great. Thank you.
I have a couple of just quick questions for you. We recently built some cedar garden boxes, and we're having such a nice garden. It looks so great. But I really want to make sure that the soil is ready for next year, so I'd like to plant some sort of cover crop. I've read that some grasses are good, or maybe just some other kind of winter vegetable. So I'd love to hear what the gentleman had to say about that. And also, I'd like to dust my plants with some sort of, you know, friendly insecticide or something to keep the bugs from eating my broccoli. But I'm not sure what to use. So thanks so much for taking my call again.
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, Kimberly, I'm really happy to hear that you are interested in using cover crops. It is becoming more and more, you know, evident that a lot of folks, not only commercial, but homeowners are interested because there are advantages of using cover crop. It adds organic matter. It provides nutrient for the microorganisms in the soil and a good habitat for them, a good food source for them. And it helps the soil in a number of ways, you know, structure, aggregate stability. So if you are dealing in cover crop, you are really interested in cover crops, and if you have not used cover crops in the past, I would suggest you use cover crops that can be easily managed or that can winter kill rather than you going in the spring and trying to till them under. Some of the cover crops are oilseed radish. That's a cover crop in the brassica family that helps with the breaking of the compaction of the soil. It helps provide good structure to the soil, a lot of organic matter too. Buckwheat is another cover crop that will winter kill, that could be used again to make your soil better. But don't just give up on other sources too. For example, compost. You know, that's also a great organic material that can be added to the soil and does all those wonderful things that the cover crop does. So use compost, and again, use cover crop that can be easily managed, so that you are not in trouble next spring when you are anxious and you're ready to plant your tomato or pepper or cauliflower. You are having this challenge of this cover crop residue in front of you.
In fact, as far as when you fill a raised bed, we typically suggest, if you can, fill that with a mix of organic matter, like 1/3, 1/3 coarse sand, and 1/3 good, well-drained, fertile soil. So 1/3 soil, 1/3 organic matter, and 1/3 coarse sand. And compost would be great as far as organic matter. As far as the holes in the cabbage and things like that, I would assume that's probably due to a cabbage worm of some type. And I would simply use a BT or bacterium that is very specific that basically kills foliage-feeding caterpillars. Product names would be things like Diapel and Thuricide. Perfectly safe for other insects, very specific. So something like Diapel or Thuricide.
Yeah, it's good for broccoli too. She mentioned broccoli.
Yep, yep. Okay. Broccoli, cabbage, cauliflower. Yes. Great.
Yeah, okay. Mostly it's like the main three insects are the loopers, then you have the diamondback moth, and then you have the imported cabbage worm. So these three are the troublemakers when it comes to a cabbage and broccoli crops.
Okay, Kimberly, sound good?
Okay. All right. Thank you so much.
Oh,
yes.
You're very welcome.
Good information.
Thank you for calling. Let's go to see if we can go to Aaron in Dubuque. Aaron.
Yep, I'm here.
Go ahead.
I have got a run of about 50 foot of, and I'm not sure what they're actually called, but they're the prickly fire bushes. If you know what I'm talking about, they've got just absolutely horrendous thorns on them, and they're impossible to weed under. And so my plan is to tear them all out at the end of this summer, and I'm hoping to plant 3 or 4 semi-dwarf fruit trees in that space with strawberries between them. And I'm wondering if I'm being overly aggressive and asking for too much from that soil, or if there's anything in particular I need to do with that soil, knowing what was in there and what's going in there, if there are anything I should be concerned about specifically with those semi-dwarfs. But again, I've got about a 50-foot run, and from what I've seen, the 12 to 15 foot is what they suggest between those trees.
Well, as far as the fruit trees, as far as requirements, basically fruit trees need a well-drained soil. That's imperative. And plenty of sun. If they get those two things, they're fine. As far as planting, you had a question?
Sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead.
Nope. Go ahead.
As far as the strawberries, I don't think I'd plant those close to the apples or fruit trees. In that, the strawberries also need plenty of sun, basically full sun. And so, if they're too close to the fruit trees, they're going to be shaded. So that's probably not a good idea. With the strawberries, again. They also need a well-drained soil also, but I would locate those away from the fruit trees.
Okay, Aaron, thank you very much for your call. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And very quickly, almost out of time, I wanted to quickly see if we could squeeze in Mary from Marshalltown. Mary, quickly, your question.
Real quickly, I have a dwarf, well, supposed to be dwarf sweet cherry tree that's about 35 foot tall. I'd like to know how severely can I prune that. I pruned some of the laterals back by 1/3 last year, but I'm taking it in steps, and I'm just wondering how far can I go?
Well, you can't prune off the top. You just can't top it. I would try to reduce the size maybe 25% every year if you can.
Sound good, Mary? Thank you.
Very good. Thank
okay. Thank you very much. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have for the show today. It's been Horticulture Day in Iowa Public Radio, Talk of Iowa. We've been joined by Ajay Nair and Richard Duran from ISU. I'm Ben Stanton for Charity Nebbe. This is Iowa Public Radio. All you do is feel up, feel up. Ain't you tired of feel up, feel up? All you do is squeeze up, mommy. Squeeze up, mm-hmm. Oh, mister, don't touch me tomatoes, please. Don't you touch me tomatoes. Touch me, call me apple potatoes. Goodness sake, don't you touch me tomatoes. Oh, mister, don't touch me tomatoes, please. Don't you touch me tomatoes.